Good afternoon, and welcome to the CONSOR's Constitution Cast. My name is Julie Silverbrook, and I am the Executive Director of CONSOR, also known as the Constitutional Sources Project, a nonprofit devoted to facilitating greater research and understanding of United States constitutional history. The Supreme Court, its history and opinions are an important aspect of our nation's constitutional history. Today we will be talking with Eric Siegel, the Kathy and Lawrence Ashe Professor of Law at Georgia State University College of Law, about the relationship between greater access to the court, its records and proceedings, and public understanding of the court and its history. I'd like to note at the outset that CONSOR takes no position with respect to cameras in the courtroom or greater Supreme Court transparency. We are simply interested in hosting a conversation about this timely issue as it relates to preserving historical records and facilitating civic education. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks for having me, Julie. I'm really happy to be here.
Let's start with two big picture questions. My first question for you is, how well does the American public understand the Supreme Court, the way that it works, and the significance of its opinions? And how does that compare to their understanding of the two other branches of government?
I actually don't think the American people understand the Supreme Court very well at all. And probably less than they understand the workings of the executive and the Congress. And the fault of that, I think, lies with the way the Supreme Court writes its decisions and how the justices carry themselves in their public lives and their public duties. So as to the first point, the Supreme Court over time changes its mind in virtually every litigated area of constitutional law, at least, which is my expertise. So whether we're talking about abortion, affirmative action, campaign finance reform, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, criminal law protections, the court changes its mind all the time. And when it does that, it writes its opinions in the language of legal jargon, text, history, precedent. But the truth is that the court changes its mind most of the times because the personnel on the court changes. But to the best of my knowledge, there's never been a Supreme Court opinion where the justices said, we are reversing a prior case today because the people on the court today think that case was wrong and we have different personnel and so we're going to change the law. They always cloak it in the jargon of legalese, but that's not really what's happening. And what they're doing there is they're hiding political decisions with legal language. So, for example, when Justice Alito replaced Justice O'Connor, the law of campaign finance reform changed dramatically. And we got Citizens United, and we got the McCutcheon case. And in both decisions, the court tries to use all kinds of fancy language to hide what they're really doing, which is changing prior law only because Justice Alito changed the voting numbers on the court when he replaced Justice O'Connor. So from the very beginning, when the court writes its opinions, I don't think the justices write them openly, honestly, and transparently, and that makes it hard for the American people, I think, to understand what the court is really doing.
I'm going to push you a little bit on that point later on in our conversation. I'm going to touch on this sense that Supreme Court opinions are actually more candid than constitutional discourse in some of the other branches of government, but I'm going to save
less
that.
Candid. Sorry, Julie, less candid. Less candid. My argument is that they're less candid.
That's your argument. We're gonna touch on that a little bit later in the conversation. I want to keep it big picture here and talk a little bit about a couple of remarks justices have made over the last several years about the decline in civics education. So, for example, Justice Scalia lamented the decline in civics education back at a Union League of Chicago talk in February. Justice O'Connor has, of course, devoted her retirement to improving civic education through her terrific iCivics project. And many of the other justices have given remarks about the importance of civic education and constitutional literacy. How does greater transparency at the court, how might that contribute to more effective civic learning?
Well, I think the more openly the justices do their jobs, the more the American people will be interested in those jobs, and the more the American people will be able to hold the justices accountable for the incredibly important duties that, you know, that they engage in. So here's one example of that. The Supreme Court gets over 7,000 requests a year to overturn, you know, lower court cases, and they grant certiorari, and it takes 4 votes for the court to decide to hear a case, 4 out of 9, and maybe 70 to 80 of those cases. So one of the most important things that Supreme Court justices do is decide which cases to hear. They hear very, very few. Those votes aren't public. The American people never learn which four justices or more voted to hear a case. So before we even get to the education part, here we're cloaked in darkness. We can't hold Justice Scalia accountable, as all public officials should be, for his votes over time in the decisions whether to hear a case, because we don't even know what they are. So that's one example where education wouldn't even help because the Supreme Court is so shrouded in mystery. And the other thing I think is if Justices O'Connor and Scalia are very serious about improving civic education, and I think it's a laudable goal, and I have to say I think Justice O'Connor has done a very good job about that in retirement, they could start by being more transparent themselves by televising their own oral arguments and their decision announcements. The American people never see the justices at work, ever. They see them on talk shows. They occasionally see them at a law school here or there. Of course, that's a very small segment of the population. But we never see the justices do their job. So I actually am going to make a fairly controversial statement. I don't think education is the problem. I think transparency is the problem.
Sure. So I guess the question I was trying to get at is the relationship between greater transparency and what we can learn by having more access to the court. So what do we learn by having greater and perhaps even real-time access to who voted to grant cert versus who didn't, oral arguments, and then even private papers, which we'll touch on in a little greater detail later on in the show?
Sure. Well, so the 9 Supreme Court justices serve on the highest court in the land, and they make unbelievably important decisions that affect all Americans, you know, every term, whether it be affirmative action, abortion, campaign finance reform. We should have some idea who these government officials are and how they do their business, and their personalities and characters, as much as their legal expertise, affect decisions. And by the way, just as a quick aside, that's why Justices Scalia and Ginsburg, who are roughly the same age, who come from a, you know, kind of a similar academic and intellectual background, Ivy League schools, lower court judges, disagree on almost every constitutional issue they're called upon to decide. It's not because they're better lawyers or different lawyers. It's because they're different people. So, for example, Justice Scalia can be extremely obnoxious at oral argument. He can also be very, very funny at oral argument. And I think seeing him at work would give the American people a greater insight into who he is. And who he is a big factor in how he decides cases. And he works for the government. So that whole puzzle leads to the following solution. Because the justices' own personalities and values and life experiences are a significant factor in how they decide cases, and because their personalities and judgments and how they live their lives can be glimpsed at oral arguments and decision announcements, the American people should be allowed to see all of that going on, especially when there is no strong reason not to. There's just no good reason not to show oral arguments or decision announcements.
Great. So this is a great segue into my next question, which has a little bit of a lengthy lead up. As you know, the Constitutional Sources Project is in the business of creating the largest online library of historical materials related to the creation, ratification, and amendment of the United States Constitution. We will eventually include all United States Supreme Court opinions in our digital library, which will then be indexed to particular provisions in the Constitution. There is an argument, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, that judicial opinions written by Supreme Court justices actually provide more transparent constitutional discourse than the other branches of government. My question is, are the opinions enough to fully understand how the court interprets the Constitution at a given moment in history? I suspect I already know the answer to this question, but go ahead and answer it anyway.
Well, first of all, it's a great question, and your project is a wonderful one, and I'm really happy you're doing it.
Well, so thank you.
That's a great point. I have a great example of what I'm talking about and why opinions are not enough. And it just happened a few days ago. Retired Justice John Paul Stevens came to my law school to give a lecture. And it was fascinating because the first half of the lecture was devoted to his experience on a submarine in World War II decoding Japanese messages. And I won't go into details about it, but this 95-year-old man in front of a room of 500 people just had us captivated with these stories of how he decoded, you know, Japanese war transmissions during World War II. But we were all kind of wondering, where this is interesting, where is it leading? He then tied into his decisions in the Fourth Amendment cases, including a big one in 1979, and how he feels about the NSA's legal controversies today, to his experience in that submarine. And what he concluded is that as a legal matter, the time, date, and place of a communication doesn't justify or does not implicate big Fourth Amendment concerns, but when the government eavesdrops on the content of the communication, that's a whole different ballgame. I don't want to get into the merits of that. My point is, he tied his personal life, values, and experiences to why he made the decision he made. Now, obviously, he didn't put any of that in his legal decisions, but to understand the decision, now we have a much richer understanding of why Justice Stevens ruled the way he did. So going back to our previous conversation, the more we know about Justices Scalia and Ginsburg and Breyer, the more we can put their opinions into an appropriate context. And yet the justices absolutely hate tying those two things together, and I'll give you a great example of that. Jeffrey Stone is a world-famous constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago, a former Justice Brennan law clerk. And many years ago, he had the temerity to write an op-ed, I think it was for the New York Times, don't hold me to that, suggesting that Scalia's Catholicism had an effect on his decision-making. He didn't take a strong stance about it. He just suggested that maybe Scalia's strong religious views had an effect on his decision-making. Scalia boycotted the University of Chicago for like 15 years after that because he was so mad at Professor Stone, who was a friend, for suggesting that something non-legal affects how the justices do their jobs. But Scalia is wrong. Just as Stevens' submarine experience clearly affected how he viewed his Fourth Amendment, all of the justices' life experiences affect the opinions. So the opinions are the legal sources, and it's great that you're doing what you're doing, and obviously the American people need access to them. But the more the American people understand who the government decision makers are who are writing those decisions, the richer context we have to evaluate those decisions.
So I'm going to ask you a question. I know the answer to this is going to be yes, but as you know, many of the justices, after they retire and after a set period of time, they donate their private papers to libraries or archival institutions. You've already suggested what we can learn from these private papers. Many of the same things that we've actually learned about the framers of the Constitution by closely studying both their private papers and their publications and public comments. I know the answer to this, but you support, I would imagine, greater and digital access to these materials.
Well, actually, I disagree with one of your premises, respectfully.
Sure.
The justices' records, when they're doing their job paid for with taxpayer dollars, the memos they write to each other, their communications that are written down to their law clerks and so on, those aren't private papers. Those are public papers. And in fact, there's something called the Presidential Recording Act, which makes the president's records, emails, papers, all public property once the president resigns. Of course, sensitive foreign policy concerns or classified information is taken out of those papers. But nevertheless, the president's memos to the Secretary of State, whatever, if there's nothing classified in there or national security importance, they belong to the public. The same should happen to the papers of Supreme Court justices, and here's why. As it now stands, they can do whatever they want, and each justice does it differently. So, for example, Justice White destroyed many of his files, including files about the landmark Miranda case, which are now lost forever. Chief Justice Berger resigned in 1986, and his papers are not available to the public in any form to 2026. And in maybe the worst example of this, Justice Brennan gave a friend of mine and somebody I respect a lot, law professor Steve Vermeil, exclusive access to all of his records for 19 years. So no one in this country, not the New York Times, not Julie, not Eric, nobody got to see Justice Brennan's papers for 19 years while one person had exclusive access. That is no good. That's not how you run a government. So what the Congress should do is pass a law, just like it did for the president, saying that the justices' papers upon retirement belong to the public, that the justices must keep their papers, and then after a certain period of time, whatever the justices in Congress get together and decide is appropriate, there should, of course, be access to those papers and digital access if that's possible. Now, of course, there might be some papers that should never see the light of day. I'm not suggesting every shred of paper. But generally speaking, those are public papers, not private papers, and education and transparency would be much better served if the American people had guaranteed access to those papers after a certain period of time.
So in fairness to both sides, what's the argument for not mandating that the justices release these papers?
That's the hardest question you've asked so far. first of all, one could argue that there are many things in those papers that are pre-decisional and private and shouldn't be released. My answer is, okay, I do agree with that. I'm not suggesting every single thing. If there are privacy concerns, they shouldn't be released. I guess there's an argument that it will deter the justices from keeping good records, except there really is no persuasive argument along those lines, and here's why. As it stands now, the judges can do whatever they want. So Justice Marshall made his papers public 2 years after he retired, which meant that sitting justices who argued cases with him privately, those records were released. That's one of the reasons Justice White destroyed his papers. Any justice can do that today. So there's no guarantee a justice's conversations with the other justices are going to be private anyway. So it seems to me a uniform set of rules that takes into account privacy concerns as well as access and educational concerns has to be the way to go.
Really, really thought-provoking points. I want to pivot away from papers and two cameras in the courtroom. And for anyone who's been following the court in recent months, we do know that someone snuck what we suspect is a pen camera into the courtroom and recorded oral argument before he then protested and was thrown out of the courtroom. I want to address the opposition to cameras in the courtroom. The argument is that there's a fear of out-of-context sound bites being shown on shows like The Daily Show or even grandstanding litigants who are trying to receive an inordinate amount of attention. My first question for you would be, are these concerns valid? And if they are valid, does the potential civic education value of having gavel to gavel audio and visual coverage of Supreme Court oral argument outweigh these concerns?
Well, I don't think the concerns are valid. And of course, no one knows what will happen. So we're talking in predictions here. However, the Supreme Courts of Canada and the United Kingdom are televised. The majority of state Supreme Courts are televised. And the universal opinion of people involved in that has been it's been a positive experience. As far as things taken out of context, if we were talking about a different governmental institution that had a public hearing open to the public that C-SPAN wanted to televise, and the person holding that public hearing said to the Supreme Court, no, we're not going to let them televise that because we're afraid of snippets and sound bites, the Supreme Court would never accept that argument, because when it comes to the Congress and the president and state agencies, there is a strong presumption of transparency and openness. So once a government institution holds a public hearing, I'm not talking about private hearings, but public hearings, and once C-SPAN is willing to spend the money to televise it, then the strong presumption is there's a presumption of access and transparency. But that presumption doesn't apply to the Supreme Court, and that's a real problem. There is a Supreme Court justice in Ohio, the state Supreme Court in Ohio. Ironically, her name is O'Connor. And she has written op-eds, and she has gone around the country saying it is ludicrous that Supreme Court oral arguments aren't televised. And she says in Ohio, they've done it for a long time, and it's only been a good thing. Julie, can you imagine how wonderful it would have been if when Justice Kennedy struck down DOMA last year and millions of gay Americans viewed that as their civil rights moment, you know, their 1964 or their Brown versus Board of Education. And Justice Kennedy, a Reagan-appointed judge from California, if they could have seen him do that, that would have been a citizenship moment, a moment of national unity that we really missed. And that is a tragedy. And speculative concerns that John Stewart might make fun of the justices, which he does anyway, should not overcome the presumption of transparency and openness.
So let's talk a little bit about what students of the court at a variety of different levels, from, you know, primary school all the way up to law school, and then folks like you and I who follow the court almost religiously, what can we gain from the video coverage of oral argument? I've had the privilege of sitting in on a few oral arguments. I think they're terrific, and you learn a great deal from being in the courtroom. What can students of the court learn from having that kind of access?
Well, starting at the law school context, which of course I'm most familiar with, I teach in a law school in downtown Atlanta that is two blocks from the old Heart of Atlanta Motel. The Heart of Atlanta Motel did not accept African Americans in my lifetime, in 1964, when I was 6 years old. That case, of course, was a big civil rights case where the Supreme Court held that Congress had the power to require the Heart of Atlanta Motel to accept African Americans. When I teach that case in my class, I point and I say, this hotel is two blocks from where we're meeting tonight. If I could show them the impassioned oral arguments by the advocates in that case, it would give much more concrete meaning to what we're doing than I can do without that. And I understand I can play the audio and show pictures, but it's not the same thing, especially to 23-year-olds today, much less 23-year-olds 20 years from now. And that leads me to my next point, which is, let's take Brown versus Board of Education or Roe versus Wade, or pick any landmark case. There is no video testament to those moments of American history forever. I mean, to have those moments lost to history, whether you're an historian or a philosopher or just a citizen, you can go back and look at presidential speeches. You can go back and look at congressional debates. You know, the filibuster was ended on national television last year. And actually, a lot of people watched that for all the reasons we want the inauguration to be on TV and the filibuster debates to be on TV. The Supreme Court arguments should be on TV.
Really excellent points. Well, as you know, we do not currently have camera coverage in the Supreme Court. We have audio coverage that's released on Fridays, not in real time. But I want to touch briefly on a resource that we do currently have access to, and that's SCOTUS blog. I was recently at a program up at the New York Historical Society where several of the participating educators mentioned how useful SCOTUS blog is to them in their classrooms. And these are teachers at the primary and secondary school level. As you and others know, the SCOTUS blog was recently denied a press credential by the Senate, which also denies them access to the Supreme Court. In your opinion, how important is SCOTUS blog to educators, including law school educators? And what would we gain if SCOTUS blog, which is a Peabody Award winner, was given a Senate and Supreme Court press pass, and what do we lose when they're not given one?
Well, first of all, SCOTUS blog is immensely important, and there are a lot of great people working there, but, you know, this kind of gets us full circle. Institutions get their personalities a lot of times from the people who run the institution. Tom Goldstein is just one of our best litigators and one of our keenest observers of the Supreme Court. It's not surprising SCOTUS blog is so wonderful. It's wonderful in so many different ways. First of all, it's how we find out about Supreme Court decisions these days, because there's no real-time way to do it. So SCOTUS blog, through various machinations, gets us real-time results. But leaving that aside, their website is chock full of information for both the sophisticated constitutional theorist and for lay people. Amy Howe writes a column that I believe Lisa McElroy started law for lay people and explains the decisions in terms that informed non-lawyers can understand. That's a really, really important service. Also, if you want to find a brief or some kind of written document, SCOTUS blog is actually the best place to go. And they have symposia on most of the major Supreme Court cases where leading experts get together and write not 50-page law review articles, which hopefully won't even exist 20 years from now, but write short, opinion pieces arguing both sides of the cases. And it's really good at presenting both sides. So I think SCOTUS blog is the most important, probably, media outlet today about the Supreme Court. And then to answer your question directly, the idea that they would not be given a press pass to cover the Supreme Court, I have a theory about that that is just a theory and I certainly can't prove, and you may think I'm crazy, but I think the Supreme Court, at least so far, there's been a big uproar about this, but one of the reasons they were denied their pass, I think, is because they represent the new and the accessible and the transparent. And the Supreme Court wants nothing to do with the new, the accessible, the transparent. And that hurts civic education on a national basis.
Well, I think that may be a contestable theory, but certainly worth consideration. Well, thank you so much, Eric, for being with us today to talk about the relationship between greater access to the court and public understanding of the Supreme Court and its opinion, and of course its personnel, the U.S. Supreme Court justices. I hope you'll join Consource every Sunday. We feature information about each of our nation's 112 Supreme Court justices, and we will have a podcast coming up where we explore the justices in greater depth and talk in part about their personalities, their jurisprudence, and I think that's something that will interest you and hopefully the public as well.
I really enjoyed this, Julie. Thanks, and keep up the great work. You guys are doing a great job.
Thanks. You too. Take care.
Take care.